Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Pet World Radio, and this is the Addictive Reef Keeping with Tyler Johnson. Stay tuned for live chats, expert guests, tips and tricks, product reviews, and many more topics.
Hey, welcome back to the Addictive Reef Keeping Show. I'm your host, Tyler Johnson, and tonight we get to talk to Richard Ross about cephalopods. This is actually quite unique. I don't know if a lot of people know that you can actually keep octopus in your fish tank or even cuttlefish and squid, but it is possible, and I've heard that it is kind of easy and not as hard as some people think. So for the people out there that don't know who Richard Ross is, he's a senior biologist at the Steinhardt Aquarium in California. He takes care of many exhibits there, even a 212,000-gallon coral reef. He even has a cephalopod breeding system at home, and he's going to share with us tonight how he does that. Richard, why don't you go ahead and share with us how you got into the hobby, what led up to your career, and basically anything and everything about you.
Well, thanks for having me on. I got into it probably like everybody else. You know, my dad kept fish when I was a little kid. And so we always had that stuff around. But by the time I was, 14 or 15, I had, you know, a room full of my own fish tanks. And my bedroom was full of fish tanks. And I was working, you know, scrubbing tanks at some of the local fish stores. And it just kind of went on from there. I got out of it a little bit when I got to college. And then actually when my daughter was born, I got way back into it. I ended up being the stay-at-home dad. So one of the things I would do to keep sane with a newborn was to have my own projects going on. So I started getting back into reef tanks and breeding everything and growing coral like we couldn't do in the 80s. And, that just went from there. I got helped establish a local reef club, started growing a lot of coral, started working at different levels in the industry again, and consulted on a coral farm out in the South Pacific. That was fun. And then when my daughter started going to school, my wife said I should do something that involves adults more often. So I started volunteering at the Steinhardt Aquarium for Matt Wandell, who I knew from online and actually in person. And that turned into a job. I was volunteering there just when the new building was about to open and they needed extra help, and I got hired part-time. And then just before opening of the new building, I went on a three-week vacation that had been planned for a long time, figuring that that would be the end of me working at the Steinhardt Aquarium, because, you know, you go away just before the biggest thing that ever happened there happened, which was the opening. You probably don't get a job there. And about a week into that vacation, I got an email that said they had figured out a way to make me permanent and full-time. And that was that. And now I'm a senior biologist, and it's awesome. It's a great job.
Oh, that's awesome. Is there any difference with you having a hobby at home and at work at the same time? Does it drive your wife nuts?
No, it drives me more nuts than her. You know, everything at home is kind of designed to be as self-sufficient as possible. So she likes it. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing anymore creeping around there's no mad scientist going on with the show tank. In this house, for the reef tank, all of the support equipment is under the house, actually, in a 40-inch crawl space. And then she kind of likes the fish room, which is my office. I don't know what you'd call it. A secret home lab is what we call it. And she kind of likes the mad scientist part of that because she can close the door and it disappears. But for me, I spend all day working on tanks, and then sometimes I lie to you not. Sometimes I come home and the last thing I want to do is work on my own tanks. But usually that only lasts a day or so, and then I do what needs to be done.
Yeah, I feel bad for the stuff that I put my wife through. I mean, I'm the same way. I have my mad scientist tanks with everything, you know, systematically, automatically turning on, and hopefully this pump works today, or I'm getting the phone call or the text message.
Yeah. Well, when I got back into it, 10, 12 years ago, I bought like an aquarium system tank that had the filtration area in the back. And I thought, great, this will be easy. And I set it up in the living room. And then as I got more and more back into it and got up to speed with the new methodologies, then an auto top-off was added and, refugium was added. And then it just started growing all over the whole living room. And when we moved houses, she made it very clear that that was not to happen again. And I can't really blame her. It was kind of a nightmare. So it looks prettier now.
Yeah, I'm riding right on thin ice as well. No more tanks at the moment. But let's talk about cephalopods. I want you to explain what a cephalopod is to everybody, because I'm sure there's some people out there that just don't know what that is, because it sounds weird. And give me an idea how easy it really is to do something like this and what species you're working with.
Right on. A cephalopod is a mollusk, so they're related to snails. And cephalopod means head foot. So a cephalopod is a mollusk that has all of its limbs arranged in a ring around its mouth. That's kind of the defining characteristic. And the most common cephalopod, or at least the cephalopod people would most well be familiar with, would be an octopus, which has got 8 legs. And then there's a bunch of different species of those. And then there's also cuttlefishes, which are not fishes at all. They're related to cephalopods. Well, not that they're not related. They are. They're kind of like a squid, which is something else people know about because they eat them in America at least more often than other sets. And then there's also the chambered nautilus, which is has got a shell, a big shell on the outside, and the animal lives inside that shell. So, yeah, and keeping them, is it hard or is it easy? That's a really interesting question. What I usually say is if you can keep a reef tank, you can keep a cephalopod. Now, we know keeping a reef tank isn't necessarily the easiest thing in the world, but I think it makes way more sense to learn how to keep saltwater animals using captive bred fish and captive raised corals, experimenting on those animals and, with your learning curve that everyone's going to have, and then get into some of the more sensitive animals like cephalopods. So I think as long as you can keep a reef, no reason you can't keep ceps.
Oh, that's great, Richard. Now, pretend that I'm a new hobbyist. Pretend, I've kept my reef tank. It's a little 10-gallon. I've had it for the last year. I've had a little bit of algae issues, but my corals grow. I'm a pretty good aquarist. What kind of species would I start with? Because I have a sallyfoot crab. My wife hates it. She wants me to get rid of it. She thinks it's a spider. Same thing with octopus. I'm not even allowed to have an octopus, but I really want one. So if there's a way that you can kind of explain to me and everybody else how to make these tanks safe so these guys don't escape, and, I have two toddlers, I don't want something that's very venomous, or I don't know, just explain, and I'll pick your brain from there.
Okay. I would say the first thing I would say is make really, really sure you want one of these animals. There's a couple things that you need to know. One, they're not going to live very long. They live about a year to 18 months for any of these tropical cephalopods. So you're really not getting into a long-term thing with it. They're also, depending on where you get them from, that year to 18 months could be 2 months, depending if if you get a wild-caught animal, it's kind of often hard to tell how old they are. So they're not for everyone just in that case, because if you're going to get attached to the animal, you definitely have a limited time with it. The other thing that you need to be aware of is feeding these guys. They need lots of food, and sometimes they will only take live food. So you have to be able to have a source for live shrimp is really a good way to go, whether that be a shrimp. They can subsist on freshwater shrimp, ghost shrimp, but they're freshwater, so it's really not the best for them, but they can do on it. If you want to breed them, the freshwater shrimp's not a great idea. You can also use any kind of bait shrimp. I'm in the Northern California area, and out of the San Francisco Bay, we catch a Craignaw shrimp. And I think without that, I wouldn't be keeping them at all. So the food's really important. And the great thing about a bait shop is the shrimp's really cheap. So it's about $16 for a pound of live shrimp. So those are the kinds of things. There's probably one more, is you need to make sure you have the right size aquarium for it. And if you get it small, it may grow depending on the species you get. You want to start it maybe in a smaller aquarium and watch it for a while, and when it gets bigger, you may need to move it to a larger aquarium. So we want to make sure that you aren't just jumping into this blind, because it is an animal. They are animals with specific needs, and it's not something to be jumped into lightly. It's not like getting a clownfish and you're going to be fine for the next 5 years with it. There's a lot of stuff going on in there. Now, you asked me a couple other questions, and I lost track of what they were, so if you can reload me, I'd be happy to address them.
Oh, yeah, that's fine, and, well said. Thanks, Richard. So correct me if I'm wrong. You said that their lifespan is 2 years?
Usually less than 2 years. I would say about a year is really what you're looking at. And that's a year from it being born or hatched till it dies. So usually when you get one, an octopus that's wild caught, it's going to be at least a couple months old already. So then already you're talking 8 to 10 months. So you can see that window really shifts.
Now, that doesn't have anything to do with captivity. That's just a normal lifespan, correct?
Just their normal lifespan. There used to be a lot of thought that it did have to do with things in captivity, that they're super sensitive to all kinds of water parameter changes, or that our lights were bad for them, things like that. Those were all just people trying to guess what the problem was until we kind of figured out that these things die anyway. It's just a fact of their life. And when they die, they don't die a pretty death. They go into what's called senescence, which is they lose control of their limbs, they stop eating, their eyesight goes away, they get really lethargic. And, the eyesight going away was people saying that, some people originally thought that our high-intensity lights blinded them, but that's not the case. Most of these animals come from reef areas where the sun is out, so they definitely can deal with it. But when they start to go, they start to go. And they can linger for weeks in that state, and it can be really distressing to some people. So it's not anything necessarily you're doing with the aquarium. Of course, you can do bad things to your water quality and have them die, and that would be your fault. But the short lifespan is just the way it is with these guys.
So now, with your system that you have at home, is it any different than any other breeding system that people would use for a clownfish?
The main difference is making sure that there is no way for octopus to escape, and that any kind of pump intake or anything like that is covered, because you don't want them reaching their arms into a pump, because that's bad for their arms going into one of those impellers. So for octopuses, making it escape-proof is pretty important. I think the easiest way to do that is to take a piece of acrylic and cut it so it fits along the back of your tank, and cut out notches and run all your cables for your heater, if you need to have the heater in the tank with it, or any pump cords or anything that you need to have in the tank with the octopus that needs to come out of the tank, air lines, intakes of pumps, outflows of pumps, and things like that. Cut holes for that, run those lines through, glue or tape the piece of acrylic in place, and then use two-part epoxy. Aquamend works great because you can remove it when you're done and kind of epoxy all of those pieces of equipment, all those lines running through the acrylic into place. And then you cut another piece of acrylic that fits over the rest of the opening, and you weigh that down with a rock or a brick or something like that, so it makes your access actually pretty easy. You can make that much more complicated if you want to, but that's kind of the easiest way that I've come up with doing it, if that makes sense to you. It's kind of hard to visualize.
No, it makes perfect sense to basically treat it like a rat.
There you go. That's a good way to think of it.
Get through anything. I've seen these things at Monterey Bay Aquarium, and I've heard of them escaping and going to other tanks and grabbing some fish and going back into the other tank. Now, that creature that's coming out of that tank is only going to be there for 2 years. It just surprises me that they have such a short amount of life in captivity and, I guess, in the wild. There's no way around that. So that's got to kind of tell me that cephalopods are kind of rare thing for an average hobbyist to have. Am I right?
Yeah, just because they're hard to ship and they don't live very long, so people really don't want them. You when Wonderpuss, which is one of the more beautiful octopuses, first started hitting the market, it's a beautiful black and white banded octopus, and it's really just kind of stunning. Its scientific name is Wonderpuss photogenicus because it is so wonderful to take pictures of. There was people who would just buy them because they were so pretty, and they got really, they got a bunch of cold water poured on them with their enthusiasm very quickly after that, because, you know, they are pretty, but they also hide, and, they're very, you have to really like these animals to really want to get into them. I did want to address just one thing you said before about the stories about octopus going from one tank to another to get food and then going back home. That's been attributed to pretty much every public aquarium that's ever been. And as far as I can tell, and I've asked a lot of people, although I always leave room to be wrong because I love being wrong, but I can't find anything that corroborates that, anything that says that ever actually happened. So that seems to be one of those old reefer tales that are out there about these octopus that go on, nighttime journeys and steal the lobster from the tank down the hall and then go back home.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so run me by a species and what you would have to do to basically get it to pair up. I don't even know anything about reproducing with this animal. Can you explain anything?
Yeah, do you want to do octopus first or do you want to do cuttles first?
Let's go with octopus since that's kind of my favorite. I'm a big fan of cuttlefish. I like how they change colors and things like that. And I heard that they're probably a little bit easier, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, they're absolutely easier because, number one, you don't have to escape from the tank for them. But let's do octopuses. Species that you're going to see are generally, once in a while now, you'll see the Wonderpuss or the Mimic Octopus come through, but they've generally slowed that one down, which is really great because we have no idea what their wild populations are like. And the reason those have slowed down is because they're only active at dawn and dusk, so they don't make the most exciting or interactive pet. The ones you're kind of going to see a lot are going to be what's called a long-arm octopus, or they're often called an Indo-octopus, which would be an adopted species, or a brown octopus is what they're called. the common names are pretty interesting, and they can also be difficult to identify. So I recommend if you're looking for an octopus, go to tonmo.com. That's TONMO.com. It stands for the Octopus News Magazine Online. And that's a great source for information for all things cephalopod related. If you happen to go to a local fish store and they have an octopus there and you want to find out what it is, you can get a couple pictures of it and post it on Tonmo and people will help you figure out what you got. So you're looking for the kind of the Indo-Pacific octopuses. When they come in, usually those are going to be the Adolphus species. And then the Caribbean octopuses, which we're not seeing so much anymore, would be you've got some pygmy octopuses coming out of there, and the name is escaping me now of the other one you're going to see. They call it the Caribbean octopus. It's a vulgaris, Caribbean vulgaris is what it is. You can get those from time to time as well. They're often caught in lobster traps and then offered to exporters, or not exporters, to collectors who ship out tropical fish rather than just catching food fish. So there, have I confused you enough there?
Yeah. Now, what kind of size tank can I get with these guys? How big do these creatures get?
I knew you were going to ask that. because the idea is so hard, it can be hard to tell what you've got. So I would say you want to get nothing less than a 30-gallon tank because you often aren't going to be sure of what you're getting. So here's where the trade-off comes. The bigger the tank is, the harder it is to know where the octopus is, right? Because octopuses hide, if you want them to hide, because once they feel comfortable and have hiding places, then they'll start to come out more. But when they're in a bigger tank, it could be harder to figure out where they actually are. Their job in the wild is to not be seen. So, yeah, I would say nothing smaller than a 30-gallon tank to start. You know, a 50-gallon tank would make me much more comfortable.
Do you have any substrate in there?
Yeah, you can do almost any kind of substrate in there. Sand is really nice. The crushed coral, you know, that just doesn't make a good substrate in general for reef tanks. It traps a lot of detritus and doesn't do a great job of doing anything but you know, getting gummed up. So sands, not Zoomed, let me figure out what – it's called Mineral Mud by – Carib Sea, that's right. Carib Sea's mineral mud is a good kind of mucky substrate. It's kind of silty, so when you put it in, you got to leave a couple days for it to get some bacteria on it and settle down to the bottom. But, you know, basic reef tank kind of substrates are going to do just fine. And then you want some rocks in there for it to hide in. If you minimize that, you'll know where it's going and where the octopus is going to go hide. I wouldn't put any shells in there because the octopus may go in and you'll never see the octopus again because it's very comfortable in the shell. Regular reef stuff. You can usually do corals in with them if you want to. You want to stay away from anything really stingy, so no anemones. And if you do a lot of softies in there, you know, you always want to be running carbon anyway to take out whatever ickies get into the water from a whole range of places. So, you know, just regular good husbandry, and you'll be in good shape if you want to run corals in with the octopus.
Now, their toxicity, is it pretty dangerous if they get a hold of you or you touch the black ink, they call it?
the ink is probably not going to do anything to you. Cephalopods, we didn't even talk about the cephalopods, put out an ink, and they use that for protection, and it can be as a smoke screen kind of, or a chemical smoke screen, or sometimes it's more blobby, and that would confuse a predator into striking the blob instead of the cephalopod itself. The ink's really not that toxic, as far as we know, to people. The fear is that a lot of octopus seem to have some kind of toxin in their bite. The blue ring octopus, which is actually one of the ones you can get pretty easily in the trade, is one I would absolutely recommend nobody get. It's a very paradoxical situation. The venom that those things have can kill you dead really quickly. So I would say avoid those. And it's probable that all octopus have some form of toxin in their bite. It's just unsure, you know, we don't know how much or how bad it is in each of the different species because that research hasn't been done yet. So I would treat every octopus like bad things could happen until you really, really nail down the ID.
Now, you talk about an octopus. Are they asexual? There's no mating pair that comes in?
They're not asexual. There's definitely males and females. You'll never see them in pairs because generally – they don't hang out in pairs. Generally, octopus are a solo animal, and they come together for mating and don't really live together all that much. And even when you get a male and a female and get them to mate, you're always running the risk of one eating the other. So it can be a little bit tricky. And they're very hard to sex, which is the other thing. So it can be a little difficult getting that all going.
So now that you have your octopus in your 30-gallon tank at least, well, what's the next step? How do I get a hold of the eggs, or how do I achieve this breeding process? Or maybe it's something that's not even possible for most Aquarius.
Well, for breeding, there's you can broadly separate octopus into or octopuses or octopi, or either one of those is fine as a plural, into two groups. One is, would be the small-egged octopus, and the other would be the large-egged octopus. The small-egged octopus have very small eggs, and they produce lots and lots of eggs, sometimes, you know, in the thousands. And when those eggs hatch, they hatch into a larvae, a paralarvae, that swims in the plankton. Just like, you know, fish, you have larvae, and it takes some time to develop and metamorphosize and then settle out of the water into more of their adult form. The problem with the small-egged octopus is feeding those larvae hasn't really been figured out in a way that makes any sense for the home aquarist yet. It's difficult to find a food that they're going to want to take, which is a bummer. And a lot of people are trying different things, and one day we'll crack it, but it hasn't been cracked yet. On the other side, you've got what's called the large-egged octopus, and when they hatch out, they're basically a miniature adult octopus, and they're much easier to feed. You can get the mysis shrimp or any kinds of different amphipods, you know, because they come out and they're several millimeters long already. You give them food that's a little bit smaller than them, and you're good to go. Species like that would be the Bimac from the western coast of California. They're a little bit difficult to get nowadays. No one's really doing them or collecting them because they do need a little bit cooler water. So there's not that many people who want to keep, you know, get a chiller and bring down the water temperature for an animal that's only going to live, you know, 8 to 10 months or maybe 12 months if you're lucky. Some other large octopus, large-egg octopus would be some of the ones from the Caribbean. And but you gotta luck out and get the right species. So breeding the octopuses is not the easiest thing in the world. There's a species that I've worked with a lot with Roy Caldwell called Octopus Chirchiae. There's no I in there. And that's a great octopus. It's one of these zebra octopuses. It's from the west coast of Central America. Great little tiny octopus. Doesn't make a great pet because you don't see it most of the time, but when you do, it's pretty spectacular. And they're a large-egged octopus. And we worked with that for several years, and we're looking to get some more brood stock again so then we can breed those and offer those as captive-bred animals for sale. And it's quite possible they're very toxic. You got to figure if something's got black and white stripes on it and is really stunning, it's saying something to the rest of the world, which is usually leave me alone. So that's a great one. It's a really pretty little octopus, and you can keep it in a small, small tank, like 5 gallons. So we're hoping to have those available. Other than that, you know, breeding octopuses is not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Well, I mean, it sounds very, very, very complicating, especially with such a short lifespan and someone, you know, getting an octopus from a shipper and then, you know, it dies 2 months later due to complications. It doesn't seem like it's a very a cheap thing to get into. Now, the system that you have at home, how many octopus do you have and what do you breed them for?
Well, currently, well, when we say breed, that's, when I was working with the octopus Chirchiae, that's the lesser Pacific striped octopus, we were working with that for research. There was a couple papers that are kind of partially started about identifying them and some of the odd behavior they do. One of the odd behaviors of this particular octopus is that we didn't talk about this. I'm going to back up half a second. Most octopuses, when they mate, the female lays a clutch of eggs, the eggs hatch, and then the female dies. One clutch of eggs, one female, end of her life. That's just how the cycle works. The lesser Pacific striped octopus doesn't do that. It lays eggs over and over and over again. It will mate over and over and over again. It will even eat while she's brooding eggs. So that's a pretty exciting, interesting thing, and it's pretty odd in the octopus world. So we were working with that. We also wanted to work with them for some genetic makeup work to run the genome of them to see what's going on. One of the kind of holy grails of scientific research is to get a cephalopod that's really easy to culture in captivity because there's so many interesting things that you could work on with them. And once we get that going with the octopus, it would be great for the hobby as well, I think.
The other octopus I'm working with, I've been working with for almost 3 years now, is the larger Pacific striped octopus, which is the cousin to the lesser Pacific striped octopus. And this thing's got, it doesn't have a scientific name yet. It hasn't been described. We're working on that. It's got stripes and spots on it. Most stunning animal I've ever seen. It was only mentioned in the notes from a in a journal in I think it was 1982, and never ever expected to see these things alive ever. And one of the collectors we were working with out of Central America caught some once by accident and sent them up to us. And they're really pretty spectacular. They also lay multiple clutches of eggs, so we've been trying everything we can possibly think of to feed these larvae, because this would be a great octopus to have in culture as well. But unfortunately, they do like water a little bit colder, so they like it around 69, 70 degrees. They come from about 40 meters down, and we just can't get the larvae to eat anything yet. We got tons of larvae, we just can't get them to eat. And that's what I got going on at home right now.
Wow. That sounds beyond Steinhardt Aquarium.
Well, the only place that's ever had these guys has been here in my secret home lab and at the lab, Rhodes Caldwell's lab at UC Berkeley. And then after Roy and I were working on them for about a year, we felt confident that we knew what we were doing with them, and then we were able to get them on display at the Steinhardt, where there is currently a female who's been brooding eggs and hatching out larvae for the last 6 months or so. Pretty cool display.
So now, this stuff that you're doing with your cephalopods at home, does it tie into work at all? Are you contributing or donating octopus to your aquarium as well?
Well, we'd like to. You know, the nice thing about having them here at the home and then at Roy's place in UC Berkeley and at the Steinhardt is that we've got, you know, we don't have all our eggs in one basket. Getting more of these animals, we don't know if we're going to be able to get any more of them. So having them spread out makes us feel much more comfortable than having them all in one place. And then the resources of all three places, it's funny because it's like secret home lab as a resource, as a scientific thing. But I guess why not? It's cool. The resources of all three are can focus on different things or just by their very nature focus on different things. So, you know, at work I'm focused on how do I make sure that these animals are good for the guest experiences. You know, what can I do to make sure that the guest can see the animal and the larva and how do we explain all that? At home we can concentrate on different things. I can spend much more time photographing behaviors or videotaping behaviors, and the same thing at Roy's lab at UC Berkeley.
Well, yeah, observation is probably one of the most important aspects of breeding. Now, I see that you're on the MBI and that you also have a website called Rich Ross. Now, do any of these kind of are these logs of your information on your breeding behaviors and observations at home?
Sure. The MBI stuff, is that true? I think everything I've put on the MBI is stuff I've done at home, because it seems a little weird to do stuff from work on the MBI to get points from, you know, from my job. But I guess that's not too weird. So that's what I do on the MBI. I'm also, I think I'm still on the council of the MBI, which is nice. It's a great organization, and I would love to see more resources thrown at it and for it to expand, because I think it's a really important. I think it's really important to kind of keep all of the breeding information in one place and make sure that everybody who wants the information can get it quickly and also get the support they need. My website, richross.org, is my website. I started it really as kind of a virtual scrapbook to kind of keep information that I wanted to get to easily accessible. And then when I started writing, I started putting local copies of everything I had written, because I had had a couple of online sites. If they change a link, then it's hard to get access to that article again. Or if you I've been fortunate to publish in print a whole bunch, and that's not really a resource that you can find unless you have those actual hard copy magazines. So it's really kind of just a way to keep everything that I've done in one place, mostly for me, because when people ask me a question, I was finding that I had to go and search the web and find my own article. So I decided to put it all in one place so I could more easily find it.
Well, yeah, if you guys want to check that website out, the links are actually right below his bio on this page. Now, you've pretty much explained to me what it takes to do an octopus, and it doesn't sound very easy. Now, I was watching a Maca video this year on YouTube, and I can't remember the company, but they were pushing these cuttlefish aquariums. Mm. And basically trying to push these people to breed them. I guess you can order the clutches online or something like that. So let's go ahead and talk about that, because that sounds more more possible for us at home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And now I just want to clarify, keeping an octopus you can do. Breeding an octopus is a whole different world. So like I said before, if you're interested in keeping an octopus, you can check out my site. There's some articles on that. Actually, somebody, Mark Levinson, if you know who he is, was just pushing me to write an article about octopus keeping. So that'll probably come out in the next 6 months or so. But also go to tonmo.com, T-O-N-M-O.com, and that's a place for all your octopus information. There's plenty of information there. But read it first before you jump into it, because they are specialized animals. Now, cuttles are a much easier animal to keep because they're more – You can get them a lot easier. The eggs are almost always available on wholesalers' lists, a lot from Quality Marine. So if you want to get them, you can go to your local fish store, find a store that will that can order from Quality Marine, and you can get some from them. So they're easier to obtain, and if you get them from eggs, yay you, right? Because, first of all, they don't ship very well as adults, especially wild-caught ones. And now you know how long you're going to have them. So you know how old they are, because they're zero when you get them, because they're in the egg. So you're going to have, if you do everything right, you'll have the maximum time with them. There's pretty much one species that comes in like that. It's Sepia bendensis. It's the one I close a life cycle on. It's a very cool animal, not very big. So, again, if you got a couple of them, you could probably keep them in a 30-gallon. Maybe a 55 would be a better way to go. You will have to separate males and females as they grow up, because males will fight with each other. So it's great to be involved in something like Tonmo, because you can say, hey, I've got a bunch of extra cuttles that I'd like to get rid of. Who wants them? And you should find takers on that. So guide me with what I can answer, because I talked myself into a corner there.
Well, I mean, I get super excited because these things kind of look like UFOs. I mean, the way they kind of float through the tank, they just kind of have that submarine kind of eerie look. Now, how do I build a tank for them? Let's just put breeding aside real quick, but let's say I want to build a tank with, little airships or something from World War II. I mean, is that possible, or do they do better in, like a refugium or a reef tank or what?
They come from a reef background. They don't really come from slow moving waters in lagoonal areas. As a matter of fact, you actually find them a lot on reefs that have been hit by dynamite fishing. It turns out that disturbed area ends up being a pretty decent place for them to live. Please, no one go out in dynamite reefs to help cuttlefish have better habitats. So a reef tank is a fine thing to have them in. There's a guy named Daniel Pond who had them in a full-blown reef, not a problem. They deal just fine with the lights. They can deal just fine with the flow. Just a regular kind of a softy tank is really nice for them. At work, the Sepia bendensis, or the dwarf cuttlefish display, is a softy tank, and the bottom is covered with mushroom corals, and I've got big leather corals of all different kinds in there. It makes a really nice display, and they can deal with the flow just fine. Of course, if you don't want to put power heads in there, because they can get stuck up against the intake, so you need to do something to protect the animals from them. But, a regular kind of reef tank setup that's got a toothed overflow and a return pump nozzle that comes into the tank, that'll work just fine.
Now, these cuttlefish, are they something that are just spectacular to look at, or they kind of bland in color?
They can be both. So again, you got to really want the animal. It's we call ourselves Ceph heads, people who are kind of excited about these guys. They are really neat, but again, you know, what is their job in the wild is to not get eaten. So they're working really hard to not get eaten, and they'll go through different phases in their life. Sometimes they're really active and they're out all the time, and we see them. That's what I call the puppy dog phase, which is from about 3 or 4 months till about 8 or 9 months, maybe even earlier. And around 7 or 8 months, they start getting more mature, and males start, you know, kind of squaring off and competing for territory, and females just kind of don't want to get involved in that, and then they start laying eggs, and that can be very interesting behavior as well. When the males square off with each other, you know, they can get these jet black and bright white patterns on them. They can change the texture of their skin as well, both males and females. So they can do a bunch of color changes. They can flash what's called a path and cloud pattern on their skin. So it looks like a cloud passing overhead or glitter lines moving through their body. Very, very cool animals. A little bit subtle, but super cool. The ones that ReefGen was selling, and actually ReefGen now is offering a captive bred Sepia bentensis through liveaquaria.com. So you can get a pair of those right from there. They also for a while had some flamboyant cuttlefish, which as their name states, they're flamboyant. They're purple and yellow and white and red, and really, really gorgeous animals. A little bit harder to keep than the Sepia bentensis, but it's still doable. That was me talking for a long time, so make sure I'm on track.
That's funny. You weren't talking for a long time. You know, I watched a show on Animal Planet, and that's when I first was turned on to cuttlefish, not in a sexual way or anything, but they are magnificent to look at. And you nailed it on the coffin with it looks like clouds coming over them, because that's exactly what it looks like. Now, I've noticed that, like, in the wild, there'll be a huge male, you know, and he's pretty dominant, and these little tiny males will somehow sneak in and reproduce with the female right underneath the male. Now, you're talking about when males and females grow up, or brothers and sisters grow up, that they kind of become aggressive. Is this sneaky behavior, is that something that you see in a tank at home?
You can, for sure. If you have a large enough tank to keep enough of them, you'll definitely see it. You'll get the male who is kind of like in sea lions, you have the beach master. So it's kind of like that. He's got his female that he's protecting while she's laying eggs. And sometimes another cuttle will sneak right in there and mate with her right behind his back while he's distracted and eating or while he's looked the other way. Some of the species in the wild, the Sepia apoma, which is the giant Australian cuttlefish, there'll be males who will literally disguise themselves as females and sneak right and swim right by the male who is guarding a group of females and mate with those females right under the male's nose. We haven't quite seen that brazenness with the dwarf cuttlefish, but pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in cichlids. The bumblebee cichlid will do that. He'll fake a female so he doesn't get picked on by the male. That's amazing that those guys can do that. Now, how easy is it to feed the larvae? You're saying you can just go get bay shrimp. Does that mean you're feeding them dead shrimp?
No, I feed them live shrimp. And here's the tricky part with cuttlefish, raising cuttlefish from the egg. Is that they go through a couple of different life cycles. So when they're small, they're really small, the size of a pea. And I like to keep them in a nursery tank then for a couple reasons. You know, a smaller tank, a little 5-gallon tank dumped into your bigger system, or some people have used larger critter keepers, things like that, or, you know, little hang-on refugiums to keep them in while you grow them up. And you want to do that for a couple reasons. The first one is if you let these little tiny things go in a 30-gallon tank, you probably never see them again, and you're really hoping that they get enough food, which is the second point. These guys eat a lot, so they're going to eat several times a day,
And if you have a giant tank that they're in, you have to put a whole lot more live food in to make sure they have access to it. If you keep them in a small tank, a little 1-2 5-gallon tank, you can put less food in because that food is going to be in closer proximity to the animal that needs to eat it. So these guys are pretty easy. You can feed them. When I say easy, it means if you get the food, you can feed it to them and they'll eat it. So what does that mean? Mysis shrimp is probably the best food that we have for them. And you can get live mysis shrimp. And the deal with live mysis shrimp is you just have to pay for it. So if you're excited about that and you want to go for it, no problem. You can buy it. You can also feed them amphipods, which are a little bit harder for them to get, especially at first. So I would say you want to feed them mysis for at least the first couple, 3 weeks. And then you can transfer over to the amphipods. The amphipods, which you can buy as, reef janitors kind of thing. You can buy them from a bunch of companies now. They're just stronger. So the younger cuttles, I've seen them actually catch the amphipod, and then the amphipod, pops or clicks or flips and can get itself right out of the grip of the little cuttlefish, which is exactly what you don't want to happen. So mysis is probably the way to go. When I was doing cuttles here at my house, I would do mysis for the first couple, 3 weeks, and then I would go down to the beach and actually collect amphipods to feed them after that. So that's one of the ways, if you're on one of the coasts, you can save some money by doing it that way. But let's be honest, we're talking reef tanks and saltwater animals. If you're into it to save money, you're in the wrong hobby.
Yeah, exactly. I know this is a little bit off topic, but I got a question for you. Is there types of macro that you can grab? I know this is way off topic, but is there macro that you can grab off of the beaches where you live and they'll survive in a refugium at higher temperatures?
It should. Some of the stuff that you'll see that grows in the tide pools might work. The alva should grow just fine. But long term, you may have problems with it because it doesn't really – it's not the same kind of stuff. But nowadays it's easy enough to get some Gracilaria or any of the different kinds of macros that are actually tropical and move them over. So I would do that. I do know some people who for a while they were collecting some of the algaes out here in the bay near my house. But it just turns out to be easier to, you can buy a pack of a nori at the store, or you can buy some of Julian's Two Little Fishies stuff. It's not that expensive and it's easy to get. So you can do it. To answer your question directly, sometimes.
Well, I appreciate you answering that question. So now on these cuttlefish, are their behavior kind of aggressive or do they just kind of swim gracefully through a reef tank?
They'll swim gracefully through a reef tank until they're getting all involved with reproduction. Then they start, the males will start facing off towards each other, and they can get pretty aggressive with each other. One of the questions that often comes up with these guys is tank mates. You know, what other kind of animals besides corals can you have in there with them? And I would generally say none because – what did I say once? I said about tank mates with cephalopods is it works till it doesn't. So you'll often see stories of people who say, I've got my cephalopod in with an eel and everything's great and it's great. And it's been in there for 2 months and everything's wonderful. And then you won't hear from them again. And then when you do track them down, you'll find out what happened was, yes, the eel ate the cephalopod because you know what eels eat? They eat cephalopod. So it's usually going to end badly. Either the cephalopod is going to eat the fish or the fish is going to eat the cephalopod. So I would recommend don't do that. Get the animals because you love them, and if you want a community tank with everything in it, that's a totally different direction to go and go that way.
Well, I got some plans on building some pretty big reefs. I got a 375, and I got a couple other 300 gallons, and I want – to kind of create that cool illusion of the ocean, the cuttlefish, and I don't see anybody doing it. Are these things expensive?
I think people aren't doing that in a big tank, at home at least, because the cuttles will often not be swimming around. So it's kind of like a catch-as-catch-can to be able to see them thing. It's not like
you look at the tank and you see fish swimming around all the time, and, you know, that's very visually pleasing. The cuttlefish can be much more cryptic. So if you, the biggest tank I think I saw somebody at home do them was a 150-gallon tank, and it was pretty cool. I mean, it was more than pretty cool. It was really cool. But it didn't have that, you know, thing that most people seem to be going for, which is lots of reef life activity going on all the time. So you can absolutely do it. And, you know, the bigger the tank, the more you could keep in there. So I'd love to see a hobbyist go with a 300-gallon tank and try a group of 10, 15, 20 cuttles and see what happens in the larger area. You know, are you going to get groups, males with different territories? Is that big enough for it? It'd be really neat to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very interesting creature. It's something that you don't see every day, and that's, you know, something that I'm kind of getting into. We're going to go ahead and take our intermission break. Michael Steffen, our producer, our main admin co-host, is going to have a few announcements for us. And after that, we're going to talk to Richard Ross about what he does at work. If you guys aren't familiar with what he does, he takes care of many exhibits there, and I'm really excited to pick his brain on the 200,000-gallon coral reef. So, Michael, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
All right. You guys go ahead and enjoy your break here, and I'll entertain our listeners for a few moments. First announcement tonight is our sponsor is thehydroforum.com. So during this intermission, take a couple minutes in the comment section below the player that you're listening to this in. I posted a link to the Hydra Forum. Click the link, go over there, check them out, register for an account. It only takes about 2 minutes to register, and it's really a great all-inclusive website. You can also listen to Tyler's past episodes over there. He has his own section in the saltwater. So go over to thehydroforum.com and register. Second announcement for tonight is our website for the radio station here. It's petworldradiostation.com. Again, petworldradiostation.com. There's a lot of things going on over there. We have a club events tab that tells it all about local clubs for swap meets and such going on, different shows and conventions that are coming up over there listed. And if your club has an event coming up, whether it's saltwater club, a freshwater club, a dog club, a cats, bird exhibition, no matter what it is, and you would like us to promote it for you, email me over the information in the digital flyer to petworldradio@gmail.com. Again, that's petworldradio@gmail.com, and we'll get you listed up there. There's also a tab for Sam Scales Art over there. You'd be amazed how much you can purchase one of these premium pieces of art that you see often in our visuals here on the show. So check out Sam's art. And the last thing over there that I want you guys to check out is the coloring contest for the kids. We're getting ready to bring it down. Tomorrow's the end date for it. Well, tomorrow night, midnight on Pacific time is the end date. And so if you got a kid or grandkid or niece or nephew, print out the Pet World Radio logo on the homepage over there. Have them color it, and then either take a picture of it with your iPhone or scan it back into the computer and email it over to us at petworldradio@gmail.com, and we'll get them in there. We're going to be picking a winner by the end of the week this week, and we will be announcing that on the Friday night show. So go ahead and get your entry in by tomorrow night at midnight Pacific Standard Time. A couple of weeks ago, Tyler interviewed Mr. Jack Dalton here on his show, and Jack gave us permission to use one of his songs here on the radio station, and here it is. It's Waterline by Mr. Jack Dalton.
Turn to no place I can go. Every part of what I saw.
That was Waterline by Mr. Jack Dalton. A lot of people don't know this, but Mr. Jack Dalton's also a marine biologist and a fellow hobbyist. So, he's quite the man. Check out Tyler's past episode of that. You can either research it here on Blog Talk Radio. And if you search for Addictive Reef Keeping, you'll get all of Tyler's episodes. Or you can go over to PetWorldRadioStation.com and go to the download section, and you can either right-click them there and download them, or you can just left-click them and stream them. But all the Addictive Reef Keeping episodes are over there, as well as all the Cichlid Life. Now, our second selection for tonight is by the username Nonconductive over on TheHydraForum.com, and the name of the arrangement is The Hydra.
Songs. Hope you guys enjoyed those. Now, me and Richard were talking backstage, and he was telling me that it's kind of hard to get your hands on the right articles and the right information. Richard, do you want to go ahead and share maybe some links or some articles or some maybe some tips or tricks that you wish you would have known before you got into cuttlefishes?
There's a lot of those, and because they're the tips and tricks, because they are a little bit of a complicated animal. So I really suggest if anyone's really interested in them, and I think everyone should be because they're the coolest animal, they just take a little bit extra understanding, check out the articles. There's an article section on tonmo.com. Just go there and check out any of the articles there. You can also browse the Seth Care forms on that website. And then if you go to richroth.org, there's a cephalopod breeding link, and then there's a bunch of information right there as well. So I would just take a look at that stuff, kind of read it, get yourself immersed in it, see if it's what you want to do and something you're going to be into, and then go for it because I think they're the coolest animals on the planet.
That's awesome, Richard. And if any of you guys that are listening have any questions for Richard, you guys can go ahead and post a comment right below in Facebook, and I'm sure Richard Ross, if he likes this link right here, he'll be notified and he can answer any questions that you guys have. Now, let's get to what Richard does for a living. Now, if you guys kind of catch this in the middle of this show, Richard works at the Steinhardt Aquarium in California, and he takes care of a lot of exhibits. Do you just kind of want to touch base with us on what you do on a day-to-day basis?
On a day-to-day basis, let's see, if you're we call them biologists. The aquarists at Steinhardt are called biologists, and or the animal keepers are called biologists. And we have each biologist will have several aquariums that they are primary for. So it's essentially their tank. They work with the curators and are responsible for figuring out what animals go into the tank, what the tanks are going to look like, and then keeping them up, the maintenance, keeping the records going. Because if you don't write it down, it's not science. So we try to write everything down. And so I have got a bunch of tanks that I'm in charge of, and so every day I go in and I take care of those. These are what we call focus tanks. So they're smaller tanks, either with, you know, a few tanks on the same system or tanks on different systems or in different rooms in different areas of the aquarium. Then we have what's called the iconic tanks, and those are the big exhibits in the building. And those are run by teams. And so it's, four, five, six different people on that team because a lot more stuff needs to be done on those exhibits. And right now I am the team lead for the Philippine Coral Reef Tank, and that's the 212,000-gallon reef tank. And Charles Delbeg is the curator of that tank, the assistant curator who's in charge of that tank. And then on that team we have Marissa Avlia, and we've got Seth Walters and Matt Wandell, and who else is on the team? Nick Yim, and I think that's it. I think I'm not missing anybody there. So, yeah, it's a pretty good team of people, and the tank is coming along. It's about 5 years old now, and we're right now in the middle of some upgrades that are necessary that we've finally been able to get time and funding to do. So we're heading into a really exciting phase.
Now, that tank, is there any videos on YouTube where our viewers can check that tank out?
Oh, there must be. I know I did a feeding video a while ago that was on Reef Builders, but I'm sure there's a whole bunch of video of that tank. So I couldn't direct you to anything specifically, but I'm sure it's there.
Now, on a tank that big, what is the maintenance? You know, how many percent of water do you guys change? You know, how many pounds of food do you feed a tank like that?
Oh, man. We feed, I would do it by volume for food. So by volume, we're feeding about 2 liters of food a day. So that's a lot. And that includes, different kinds of mysis, Hikari mysis, PE mysis, reef nutrition products like their roe product, their real oyster egg product. Then we do, for the bigger fish, we'll do a lot of some kind of seaweed, lobber, or something from Two Little Fishies, and then we'll also do chopped clam or chopped prawn, or we do a bunch of different kinds of pellets. So there's definitely a lot of food going into that tank. I think right now it's about 2,000 fish in there, so they all have to eat. And we also have a lot of little fishes. So one of the tactics we've taken, or one of the ways we've angled that tank, is to make it look like what you would see in the wild. So it's based after a couple of spots in the Philippines, and when we were there a few years ago, we noticed that, you know, the tank, the reefs are covered in anthias. There's anthias all over the place. So we've worked on doing that, and I think it's working out pretty well. We got a bunch of different kind of anthias. We got Randall's anthias. We've got Squama pinus. We've got Tuca's, the purple queen anthias, and they're doing really well. The trick with them has been feeding, so we've got a whole bunch of besides just the 2 liters by volume of food we put in, we also have what's called the auto feeder, which is there's 4 peristaltic pumps that pull a food mix out of a reservoir and feed it to 4 different areas of the tank off and on all day. And if you do a non-photosynthetic system, you're probably used to hearing about that kind of feeding system. But what we put in there is things like cyclopes, and we put eggs in there, and there's rotifers in there. So there's stuff for the smaller fishes to eat and chew on all the day long. Maintenance on that tank, is that what the other thing you asked about, Tyler?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure the percentage of water that you guys change on there, you know, is it kind of the same as what we change in our home aquarium?
Well, we started out with not wanting to do a lot of water changes on it because, you know, salt water is expensive. If you're doing a 20% water change on 200,000 gallons, that's, you know, you can do the math. It's 20 million gallons, because I don't want to do the math, so I'm just saying it's a million gallons. It's a lot of water, and that adds up quickly. But as time has gone by, we've been able to make the case that we really should do more water changes when we can. So every week we've got 4 giant sand filters on the tank. That's the mechanical filtration. And every week those get a backwash, and we get probably about a 4% water change every week. It's about 4,000 gallons, 5,000 gallons. And then 4 times a year on 4 of those for 1 month, so 4 water changes, we'll do a 15,000-gallon water change on that backwash. So we end up doing about a 60,000-gallon water change over the course of that month. And I think that's an important thing for us to be doing.
Now, that mechanical filtration, that's getting me excited. I have a bio sand filter. I got a bio sand filter on my 300-gallon hot tub that I converted over to a frag tank.
Uh-huh.
Now, I removed the sand. I still have the pipe with the 5 fingers that comes out that fluidizes the sand. Now, I've heard risky things about these nitrate factories. How does your guys' work? I guess you take them offline. Is that why they don't expel the nitrate back into the system?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, actually, I think. Actually, I think all of this is really interesting. it's not fluidized. These are sand bed filters that have 3 different grades of media in them, a coarse, a medium, and a fine. And so it really works like a bonded filter pad, like a floss filter, except giant, and sand is your floss. They can, just like a fluidized bed, become, you know, what people call nitrate factories, and that's when they become bioactive. So we actually don't want any bacteria in these sand filters. So what we do is we've just been keeping track of nitrates in the tank, and when the nitrates get above 16 is when that's kind of our trigger point, when we start looking at it squintily, where we're going, are we rising too high? And when that happens, we start when that's not happening, we backwash, meaning we reverse the flow in the sand filter. So all the detritus that's been collected in the sand, we push it back out of the sand, and then that goes to drain. So we're exporting all of that material out of the sand filter. And we're usually doing that with water from the aquarium, because when we do that, we end up getting a bigger water change, which is what we want. But if we're getting too many nitrates in the tank, we'll start flushing the sand filters with city water, which is chlorinated, which should kill all of the bacteria that might show up in there. So that's a long way to answer your question.
Wow. So let me just put this in in my terms, I guess, so I can understand this. If I was to build something like this, let's say I got a 1,000-gallon aquarium, and I have I have this filter, because I have these backwashing systems. I have quite a few of them, and I've thought about using them. I just fill them up with live rock, and once a month I turn it off, flip the lever to backwash. I backwash my live rock, and then whatever I drain down the driveway or into my yard, I replace with brand new salt water. Now, I like the fact that you guys are sitting there monitoring the nitrates. So that's what's happening, is the detritus is collecting so much that it's creating a nitrate spike, and you need to basically run chlorinated water through it or backflush it and get it out of the system. Am I correct?
Yeah, kind of. The stuff that's building up in the filter is it's just starting to break down naturally. So that either you get it out before it really starts to break down so it doesn't release ammonia, which is then converted into nitrate and then nitrite and then nitrate, or it becomes kind of a biological filter, which is then producing the nitrate, and you want to kill off that bacteria to make that stop. Does that make sense? Did I answer what you were asking there?
No, that makes perfect sense. You know, and I just want there to be a way to where most Aquarius can have. I'm addicted. You know, I'm a junkie to reef and corals and things that look pretty. I like it. I like big tanks. I got a lot of tanks that I want to be able to take care of them cheaply. And I read all these articles of all these people with these 800-gallon tanks, and they have to sit here and change 60% of their water twice a month, or they're doing these big water changes, when I feel like it could be accomplished with maybe an algae scrubber or, you know, reactors or your guys' method. So, you know, I like to hear that there's an easy way, since you guys are only changing out 4% of water each week. So I guess it keeps the bill down, you know, on a monthly basis versus it costing so much money.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I would call what we're doing easy. We've only talked about the sand filters there. There's a lot more to this big tank than the sand filters. But I would say, you know, and I get myself in not really trouble, but people get annoyed with me because people want to be told what to do. They want answers. And I call those recipes. And I don't really think there are reef-keeping recipes. You know, I've never written an article that says, you know, this is how you set up a reef tank. All my articles are, here's a bunch of general information. You've got to absorb this and run your system in a way that makes sense to you with this kind of background. I wish I could just say this is how you should do it, but I don't really think there's a way to do it. There's a million ways to skin a reef, and I think the best way to approach a reef tank is develop a blue thumb or a saltwater thumb, where you kind of get a decent understanding of everything that might be going on in the tank, so then you can address it in ways that make some kind of sense. So given that, you know, there's definitely a place for algae turf scrubbles. Actually, I have one here from Inland Reef, because in my home tank, my phosphates are really high. If you go to Reefs Magazine, Chris Jury and I wrote an article about it. So my phosphates are like 0.125. They're very high, and so we're thinking about running a algae turf scrubble to see what that does. Traditionally, you know, there's debate about are they good with SPS tanks or not, but you know, so there's every kind of way to run a reef. So, you know, you're talking about the guys with the big tanks, the 800-gallon tanks who are doing 66% water changes. I don't know if that's necessary. I don't know what they're doing that's making them do big water changes like that. Or perhaps they have just fallen into the idea that if they don't do the big water change, bad things will happen. Whether or not that's true or not is a whole other question.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, and that's why I read out there. I read all these couples, because a lot of these tanks are couples own it, and they're doing these massive water changes. And I myself, I guess right now I only have one algae scrubber, but I've ran many algae scrubbers. And for the people out there that don't know the difference between microalgae and macroalgae, microalgae is insane at exporting nutrients compared to your dragon's breath and your Shade Amorpha. I mean, the stuff rocks, and if you guys think about it, when it's in your tank, you have hair algae in your tank, 9 times out of 10, or 99.9% of the time, your phosphates are going to be zero, and your nitrates are going to always be zero if you have it in your display. So why not use it as a form of filtration?
Yeah, and at the same time, I've never run one before and never had a problem. So, you know, I don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah. Well, so, that's something that we were discussing, too, behind the scenes. You know, we're saying there's not just one way to take care of a reef tank. There's a million ways. And one of our first shows was setting up a reef tank. And I was like, guys, this isn't the way to set up a reef tank. This is how I run my reef tank. It's
right,
what works
right,
for
right.
me. You know, that's the biggest thing I try to tell all our listeners. And that's another thing, too, I want everyone to know. I'm going to talk to Michael about this, but we're going to get Richard Ross, Jim Welsh, Mark Livingston, and maybe some other people, and we're going to do a show on nuisance algae and maybe something on two-part dosing or something along the lines of those. So I just want everyone to know that, you know, what we're going to be doing down the road, and I look forward to having Richard on there helping us.
I'm happy to do it. Thanks.
So you've been in the hobby for the last 25 years. What have you done throughout that whole entire career, or I guess passion of a hobby?
I remember when I was starting is when file balls were a new thing, and we were trying different kinds of hair curlers instead of a bio ball because it was cheaper than the bio balls. And I remember driving all over L.A., to different importers to get different bio balls. It was very exciting, and it was you had to do bio balls. And now, of course, nobody really wants to do that at all. So it's kind of I think when you're around long enough and you see things come and go, you start looking at all those things kind of like, well, I'll let some other people experiment with this, and then 5 or 6 years we'll see if there's really anything to it. But in terms of tanks, I've kind of kept almost everything. It's been a really nice run. It's pretty exciting stuff. I hope that addressed your question too.
Oh yeah. Well, being a marine biologist, you know, I never gone down that path. You going through college and things like that. What are some of the differences from being, you know, becoming a marine biologist and getting into the hobby that way, and now it being your job.
That's really important. I don't have a degree in marine biology. I have a degree in philosophy, which is so much more useful. you can get a job as a philosopher nowhere. I threw it to the public aquarium world totally hobby-driven. And there's a lot of people that come to it that way as well. In public aquarium field, because let's face it, you could go through a whole marine biology course, and that's not marine husbandry, right? Being in a marine biology degree or in a marine biology class doesn't necessarily mean you'll get any information or have experience keeping animals alive. You can, sometimes you do, but it's not necessarily what's going to happen. So, I think experience, trying to keep animals alive, I think experience is really what matters, because you can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you haven't kept a reef tank, you know, you can read a book, but you don't have that blue thumb we were talking about before. So I came through it, all self-taught, reading everything I could. When I got back into the hobby in 2000, after I took a little break, I was thrilled that Julian and Charles's books were out, and I kind of hit those just like textbooks because those are essentially textbooks, the Reef Aquarium Volume 1, 2, and 3. So I think, you know, you just got to learn it.
Yeah, now I sat here and read your bio, and it's pretty interesting, some of the things you've done. I see that you've done some of the underwater videoing, you've done some fish breeding, some coral farming. What's the story with coral farming and kind of how can us hobbyists help bring more coral to the ocean? I don't know if there's facilities that do this that get paid by the government or get paid by some organization. Do you know any thoughts on that?
About how to get more coral farming happening? Is that what you're asking?
Well,
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I can't remember the guy's name, but there's a guy that's from Israel that goes around to all these, the Philippines and all these coastal reefs and helps build these coral farming projects. And I didn't know if that was something that you, you've done or that you've been a part of.
Well, I was part of a project that was going on in Tonga, and that didn't pan out for various reasons. You know, coral farming is, well, let's step back a second. Doing anything on an island in the middle of the South Pacific is not necessarily the easiest thing in the world to do, because you're on an island in the middle of the South Pacific. And, you know, in Tonga, a 20-foot length of half-inch PVC costs $30. So it's expensive, and there's only so many of them on the island. So that was a really interesting experience, and I'm glad I went through it. I learned a lot, and I wish that the project had been more successful. But, you know, that if businesses were easy, they would 90% of them wouldn't fail in the first year, and if coral farms were easy, more people would do them. But how do you support coral farming is any coral farms, any farm coral, you should be buying that. I mean, that's
yeah.
The simplest answer is that the money is where the only thing that's going to make it continue to happen is by paying for it. So now we got, you know, coming out of Bali and some other places, there's some great cultured coral, and some of the places are really, really doing it right. You know, they're taking frags of mother colonies. They're not destroying the mother colonies. And then they're growing their own mother colonies from those, and that's what they're taking fragments from. So that's just fantastic stuff. So what I think we need is we need more and easier ways to get the coral that we know has been farmed and farmed responsibly. And I'm a huge fan of farming the coral locally to where the coral is from, because I think we as reef keepers have a vested interest in doing everything we can to keep the ocean healthy and vibrant. And giving the local people there a reason to not destroy their reefs to feed themselves by having them farm coral where they can make a living from that is way better than not necessarily having a living and having to result to subsistence fishing, which may result in blast fishing, because let's face it, if you need to give your daughter food, you're going to do whatever you can to make that happen. But if instead you're farming and someone's giving you money for that coral, everybody wins. So I'm a big fan of local coral being grown in local areas in the South Pacific. So I like those programs the most. Doing it land-based is great as well. ORA does a fantastic job, and they're even better because they also have projects out in you know, in the South Pacific where they're funneling energy back to where these corals come from. I get really nervous that we lose sight of the idea that that we are connected to the ocean and we are extracting resources from the ocean to put stuff in our living rooms. And I think I would like to see us as a community taking more responsibility for that and doing more to make that better in the long term. That's my soapbox.
Well said, Richard. I mean, you are exactly how I feel about reefs. You know, I'm getting ready to start a greenhouse. I'm going to start frag farming, if you want to call it. And I'm not doing it for business reasons or anything like that. I honestly want to be able to donate back. And I'm in the process of working this organization that us reefers can give back to organizations or whatever to bring back the reefs or whatever and do the best that we can. The coolest thing, like you said, that those people that take that one stick from the ocean and take that mother colony and grow it up and frag that, we are building its immune system. We are making it stronger, and it's an aquaculture coral, so it's going to last longer. It's going to be able to be fragged right away instead of, you know, having to wait a year until it gets used to our lighting. So I'm excited that you feel the same way about that. We're definitely going to have a show on restoring the reefs, because I want to get more people's opinion on you know, what we could do as hobbyists to help the hobby. And I like the fact that you said grow and sell local. That's something that I do, and we just kind of trade amongst each other.
That's good stuff. A lot of good articles, a lot of good information. In fact, some of the only real journalism being done on the topic coming out of Rhett Talbot. So you could look up his stuff. You know, he publishes in a bunch of different places, and he's good approach to it. I can't agree with him more with almost everything he says, and I think that's the way to go. We have to understand where the wild-caught animals that we depend on are coming from and what's going on in those communities, because without helping them, we're in trouble. I'd like to see reef clubs be harnessed more, and, you know, reef clubs, most of the reef clubs I know are sitting on a pretty decent bank account for rainy days, and I'd like to see that used. I'm going to get off topic, but, you know, used to send money, you know, just projects back out in the field where it's needed, but also for some basic research about our tanks that we don't know much about. You know, I'd love to see a whole bunch of simple studies done by different reef clubs, from anything from, you know, does this product does what it says it does? Do we get better growth if you add this product or not? That's a simple side-by-side study that could get us moving in the right direction. So I think we could be very lucky, and we could be moving into a time where the internet and communication and shows like yours are bringing people together and ideas together, and we can all work together as an extended community to make a difference and to make things better and easier. So sometimes I get really excited about that.
Let's start a riot. No, I am totally down for that. You know, you're mentioning people taking things from the ocean and building things at their house. You know, they're actually use coral toxicity to cure cancer. It's a form of chemotherapy. There's tons of research that needs to be done with these corals, and I like that you bring up the fact of organizations getting together to basically, you know, figure out how we can replenish the ocean. That's the biggest thing. Is I see all these people that are working, like you said, working towards greed, working towards, I got to make this money, I got to do this, and no one gives back to the person to the ocean, to Mother Nature at all, and that's the ones that suffer. So it's like you're mentioning on that octopus, on the mimic octopus, they're taking so many of them and not even knowing what's in the ocean.
Yeah.
I think I read online that we only know like 5 or 6% of the ocean. That's it. That's sad. All we care about is aliens.
Well, yeah.
Richard, I just want to say thank you for all your information on the cephalopods. I think everybody can appreciate that. It's something that not a lot of us get to hear. It's something that we don't even think about. Octopus and cuttlefish are kind of rare to have in your tank. But before we go tonight, is there anything that you want our listeners to know? Any tips or tricks? Anything that you wish you would have known? You know, patience is a good one. But is there anything that you'd like to tell our viewers? Any shout-outs? Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I would say the big one, and that's my recent article is about this in Reefs Magazine a little bit, is don't go chasing numbers. A number on a test kit is not what you're trying to accomplish. You're not trying to accomplish a phosphate of 0.05, wherever that number came from in the first place. What you're trying to accomplish is healthy growing animals in your tank. So don't get caught up with the idea of this is a number that I need to reach. It's not about necessarily the numbers. Test kits are great for making trends and seeing what's going on in your tank, but you don't necessarily have to be trying to shoot for a specific value. The other thing I would say is, you know, I have a skeptical reef keeping series where I talk about being skeptical and think critically about everything you want to do. And think critically about anything anybody says to you that you should do, because everyone's got an opinion, and not everyone's opinion can be useful or right.
even mine, especially mine. I love to be told that I'm wrong, and then it actually turns out I'm wrong, because that means I've learned something. So look at everything that everybody says with a little bit of a critical eye and see if you can find some consensus before you jump on any bandwagons, because your animals deserve it.
Awesome. Well said, Richard. You know, and that's another thing me and Jim Welsh talked about, is find a mentor. Find somebody that you can look up to, and I'm sure Richard is a great mentor, but find somebody that you can look up to and learn from, because that's how you really get far in the hobby. And I'm sure since you've been having tanks since a little kid, you probably had a mentor that got you to the point where you are now.
Yeah, absolutely. And when my suggestion on that is find someone who's got a tank that you want your tank to look like. And that's a good mentor for you. Because if their tank isn't what you want your tank to look like, why should you follow their advice? That's pretty straightforward and good. And man, we're so lucky to have all the stuff on the internet where we can just reach people and instant message with people and help troubleshoot stuff and get information. It's a great time to be a reef keeper.
Well, you know, and that's something that you brought up too, is be nice to others when you're giving them info. Yeah, that's the reason, no offense towards forums or anything like that, the forums that I experienced, but I got away from it because I saw too many people that were new to the hobby just get annihilated with information saying that they're doing everything wrong and that they shouldn't even be having a reef tank or saltwater tank. So, you know, I don't know, find a group on Facebook and get your information from someone that has credibility and that can't hide behind a username. Richard, are you on Facebook at all?
I am.
Very good. You need to join our group, Addictive Reef Keeping.
I'll do that as soon as I get off here.
Okay, yeah, guys, check that group out. That's, I don't know, I think we're at 3,100 members. It's been on there for a little over a year, and all the experts are there. Everybody you can think of is on there, and you guys can ask a question. And 9 times out of 10, guys, the question's answered or on its way to being answered within a minute or two. So check it out. You can ask Richard any questions there. Thanks again, Richard, for coming on the show. Is there anything else that you want to say before you say goodnight?
No, I think we've covered it all. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome, Richard. Well, guys, thank you for listening to the Addictive Reef Keeping Show, and don't forget to sit back and enjoy your pets.
You're listening to Pet World Radio, and this is the Addictive Reef Keeping with Tyler Johnson. Stay tuned for live chats, expert guests, tips and tricks, product reviews, and many more topics.